We're going to deal with the trial of Jesus itself. We've talked about the expectation of the coming of Jesus to the mankind. Then we talked about the events which happened on the day of the crucifixion. And then we talked about some of the events which we can see happen and the evidences of the resurrection of Jesus. But today we're going to talk about certain things in conjunction with the trial itself. Who was the governing body of the province of Judea at this time? Or what was the governing body? Yes. The boss of the whole province was, what was his name?
Pilate.
Now, under him, the Jews were allowed a great deal of latitude with respect particularly to their own laws. And what was the body that did the governing at that level?
Sanhedrin.
How many men composed the Sanhedrin?
73.
Right. 70, and sometimes it went up as high as 72, apparently. Sometimes 71. Were all of the members of the Sanhedrin of one, what we would call, political party?
No.
How many parties were there, and what were their names? Yes, there was the Pharisees, Sadducees, and scribes that are mentioned in the scriptures. There may have been more. There were the Essenes that we talked about, they found about in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But I want to make one thing clear, and that is that a lot of people think that the, this is still a little blocky, I guess, here. A lot of people, is that any better? Think that the word Pharisee is spelled like this. That is not true. There is no similarity between the two, whatever, I hope. Well, the difference between the does anybody know the difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees? What the real root of their...
Resurrection of the dead.
Yes. Which one believed in which?
Pharisees.
Yes. The Pharisees believed in angels, the immortality of the soul, and future rewards and punishments. The Sadducees did not. They denied the resurrection of the dead. They denied angels and spirits and the immortality of the soul. Now, the Pharisees believed in the written law and the oral law. The Sadducees only believed in the written law. They would have no part or parcel with the oral law. Now, the oral law embellished the written law with all these touch not, taste not, and handle not. And that's why they were so meticulous about piety and the way that things were done. Sadducees were more of a political party. They wanted to work out their salvation through politics. The Pharisees wished to work out their salvation more through piety. The scribes advised the court on matters of procedure and were responsible for writing down any matter which required a commission to writing. Now, with that background, we want to come to the trial itself.
How was the body gotten up? Was it an elected body, or just how did it come up?
Seemed to be by appointment, I think. I don't think they had any elections in the sense that we have them. But I'm not sure about that. Maybe some others have knowledge of that point.
Well, in those days, they used casting a lot in place of Democratic vote anyway, so it wouldn't have used the vote. Would it be the appointment by the high priest?
I don't know how they were appointed.
Do you know?
Pardon?
Do you know who appointed them? I've never heard.
No,
of them.
I don't know who appointed them. Now, at this particular Passover, we've already talked about the excitement which was in evidence in the country, and some writers estimate that 3 million pilgrims came to Jerusalem on this particular Passover. This figure seems high to me, but it no doubt was a full house, at least. The Roman garrison was increased because of the large number of people. The more people you have gathered, the more policemen. And Pilate also came to Jerusalem at this Passover from his home in his castle in Caesarea. Now we come to the meat of this whole drama, and I would like you, we'll be flipping back a little bit among the four Gospels again. I'm sorry that one writer does not give the complete story, so you'll have to be finger dexterous, I guess, to flip back and forth as we go through. But in the seventh chapter of John, we find that they had tried to arrest him before. This was not their first attempt. And this is rather interesting, too, this little tidbit that John gives us here. It's in the 32nd verse of chapter 7. Brother Tuzio, will you read that? John 7 and 32.
The Pharisees heard that the people murmured such things concerning him, and the Pharisees and the chief priests wanted to take him.
Now, do you get that? That the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. Now, this is quite a remarkable thing, actually. In verses 45 and 6, we have the result of this attempt to take him. Brother Nickerson?
Then came the officers of the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said unto them, why have you not brought him? The officers answered, never a man save like this man.
Now there is a remarkable result. A temple guard is sent to take him, and they come back empty-handed. And they said, well, why haven't you got him? Never a man spake like this man, is the answer. Now, we've already mentioned in John the 6th chapter, verse 15. Oh, no, we haven't mentioned this, but we will now. There were a couple of incidents which threatened the position of the ruling body, the Sanhedrin. And this incident is one. We'll read this, and then as we read, I would like you to figure out why this would threaten, if this were accomplished, why this would threaten the position of the Sanhedrin. Brother Russell?
John 6:15.
Yes.
When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again unto a mountain himself alone.
They tried to make him a king by force. If they had succeeded, and the Pharisees didn't know whether they ever would or not, maybe they try it again and succeed, how would this threaten their position? Yeah, because if he's going to be the king, then obviously they aren't going to be in the ruling position anymore. So this was a great threat when the people wanted to make Jesus king. This could not be. I mean, this had to go. Now again in the 11th chapter, with respect to the raising of Lazarus, we've read this quite a bit in John 11 and 48. Ernest? John 11 and 48.
If we lay him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and his name.
So their position was threatened, right? And this is another reason why they wanted to get rid of him. Now in the 26th chapter of Matthew, verse 3 to 5, inclusive. Jim?
Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people under the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not on a feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people.
So you see that there was on the part of the people a great affinity at this time for Jesus, because apparently they were afraid that if they took him in the presence of all the people, common people, that there would be an uproar. And uproars they did not want, particularly at this time when a lot of money was to be made with visiting pilgrims. So they were a little bit nervous as to just what to do. They wanted to get rid of him in the worst possible way, because they're afraid at this particular time at the Passover, when all these thousands of people were gathered, if he performed some spectacular miracle like the raising of Lazarus again, that they might make him a king by force right there on the spot. So they were very anxious to get rid of him. Now there became an ingredient in the act in the 22nd chapter of Luke which was very fortuitous. Now this is in the 22nd chapter of Luke, verses 3 to 6 inclusive. Mrs. Ferguson, will you read that?
Then as he spake unto the Jews, surnamed Iscariot, being of the number of 12, and he went his way, and communed with his chief priests and captains, now he might betray him unto them. And they were glad and covenanted to give him money, and promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude.
No, yesterday, or maybe it was the day before, I think I mentioned that Judas had some information which was of exceedingly great value to the high priest. And a brother came to me after and said, I don't understand what you mean. So maybe I can explain a little bit better now. But there were two or three occasions when Jesus was threatened. One was they were going to take him by force and make him a king. We've already read about that. And he went his way wouldn't let them, and on most of these occasions the sentence is given because his hour was not yet come. Another one was at Nazareth, where they wanted to push him over the precipice, and he went through the crowd and escaped. Why? Because his hour was not yet come. But there was a time coming when his hour was going to come, and he had notified the disciples that, behold, I go to Jerusalem to be crucified. Now, I don't know, it says the apostles were dull of understanding. Maybe Judas had a little more understanding on that particular point than any of them, because he seemed to recognize that there was coming a time when his hour was come and Jesus would no longer go through the crowd, the temple guard, and escape, but that he would go as a lamb to the slaughter. Maybe Judas had more understanding on this point than any of them. We don't know. But it looks as if he did, because it says here, and he promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude. And apparently he would know that Jesus was ready to be arrested, and that he could have perfect knowledge as to how to fit this in together so that they could arrest him. There'd be no multitude. And Jesus, on the other hand, would not use his power to go through the crowd as he did when they wanted to push him over the precipice. So when Judas had this knowledge and he took the money to give the people this, the Sanhedrin this knowledge, they came out finally, and this is in all the Gospels, and the temple guard arrested him, no doubt on a warrant from the high priest. So if we turn now to John, we won't read about the arrest. I think you're all familiar with it. They came into the garden and arrested him. But if we turn to John, the 18th chapter, we now come to the first part of the trial itself. Now, this is a complicated business to just piece together exactly. Many writers have tried to do it. And if you quarrel with the order, chronological order, which we now take up, I will not fight you, because we are not here to act as if we have got this thing all worked out 100%, but at least I think what we have to say will show you the general order of how things happened during those early hours. So after the arrest, apparently the first thing that happened was contained in John 18 and 13. Will you read that, Brother Cook?
John 18:13.
Yes.
And led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, but the high priest that same year.
Now, what relation was Annas to the high priest Caiaphas?
Father-in-law.
Now, Annas had been high priest, but he was deposed for chicanery and bad action. Josephus has something to say about that. He had exceeded his authority, and the Romans removed him. So it's nice to keep things in the family. You know, it's always nice to have somebody in the family on the board. So he was astute in getting his son-in-law, Caiaphas, to be high priest. But it, from sort of reading between the lines here, it sort of looks as if Annas still had the thin hand on the shoulder of his son-in-law and was doing a lot of the directing behind scenes. This often happens, as you know.
Caiaphas over Pilate?
No, he was under Pilate. He was the high priest, though. He was the chief man of the Sanhedrin. But he was still under the authority of Pilate, as we're going to talk about in a minute. Who was?
Herod?
No. Herod was king of the province of Galilee this time. The only person apparently that Pilate had to answer to was either the emperor or the emperor and the senate of the Roman people.
But so Herod was a temporal authority, wasn't he? Annas was only Caiaphas was only a religious authority. Wasn't Herod the like the civil authority over the Jews? He had no religious significance.
Well, there were. When you get into the chronological tree of the Herods, you're good for 3 hours. And there were several Herods mentioned in the Bible. Do you mind if we leave that? It's a complicated business. But the Herod mentioned here that we're going to talk about in a minute was the Tetrarch of the province of Galilee. So that when they brought him to Annas, there was no thought of a fair trial and really to try the thing. What was their only thought, really?
Do away with
them. We'll go through the mockery of a trial, but never mind all the niceties of Jewish legalism. Let's get rid of them. So they take him first, right, to Annas. Well, it says here, they led him away to Annas first, doesn't it? That's the first thing that happened. They'd the next verse, this is 19. Eddie?
The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples.
Now, who was the high priest?
Yeah.
Yeah. Side by side. A Roman castle was there, too. They were all in a, just like around here in a very short area. So now we have them before Caiaphas. No doubt Annas was there, too. But Caiaphas... Yeah, I don't know just whether you'd call it, this isn't, I don't think he was impudent here, but he was just quietly asking them, well, you've got me here, now you want to know my doctrine? Where are my accusers? And we'll talk about that in a minute too. There was nobody there to accuse him. They were asking him, and he says, I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, and you want to know what I taught? Get the people that are accusing me. Why did you arrest me? What's the charge I'm here for?
Time of day. Well, was it in the evening, wasn't it? It was taken in the evening. Wasn't it evening then at that time?
Well, in the second lesson, I gave a list.
28th verse, it says, then led they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early.
Yeah, I think it was about 4 a.m., but I don't know, not being there. And do you mind leaving that?
I don't think you had right on the 50th.
No, I don't really know what time it was.
He said it was early.
Right. Now, in verse 24, it says, now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas, the high priest. So here he is now before Caiaphas, and he questions him about his doctrine and so on. Now, here's the thing about, I'm no lawyer, but this is what happens. Under Jewish law, and even under American law, when a man is brought to court, somebody has to do the accusing. Now, even today, when a drunk or an assault case is brought before a court, somebody has to sign the warrant. Usually, now, it's a police officer. But under this scheme, they had no police. So if anybody had a fault against anybody, either a civil fault, an assault fault, or a criminal fault, they went to court. And they were there was no lawyers in the sense that we have now. The thing wasn't all a big hoax like it is now. If I had a fault against somebody, I took them to court and went there and before the judge and made the accusation and told what happened, and he would tell, and the judge would decide what should be done. Now, you can even do that today. If you're driving along the highway right now here in New Hampshire, and some idiot cuts in on you and you have to take the ditch and wreck your car and you get his license number, if you want to, you can take him to court. You don't have to go to a policeman or anybody else. You can go into court, swear out a warrant for his arrest, and sign it, and they'll arrest him and bring him to court. You can go there and say, now, I was riding along on a certain day and this fool cut me up and I had to smash my car up or else have an accident. And the judge will decide. Well, that was the only way in those days that this, in the absence of police, that this sort of thing could happen. So, was there anybody coming to court and saying this man did something wrong?
No.
So the thing was illegal from the start. There was no accusers. Now, in order to make the thing halfway respectable, they had to have accusers there. They had to have somebody there to say this man is accused of a fault, and here it is. And this was the defect, or one of the defects, in the trial. So, the next thing that happened apparently was, after Caiaphas didn't seem to get very far with this, is contained in Matthew, the 26th chapter. And this is in verse 57. Well, this is actually the same that we've talked about. And they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. So now, not only is he before the high priest personally, but he has gathered around him at least some of the Sanhedrin, the scribes and elders of Israel. Now turn to Mark. There's a little aside here in Mark that we should look at. This is in the 14th chapter of Mark, and verses 55 and 6. Well, the 53rd verse actually gives us the same thought. They led him before the high priest, and in with him were assembled the chief priests and elders and scribes. They were nearly all there. Now in verses 55 and 6, Priscilla Millay, will you read that?
And the chief priests and all the council sought the witness against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. For many bear false witness against them, but their witness agreed not together.
Now this is a pretty serious thing they're faced with. Here they hail a man into court, and they're trying to get somebody to put the finger on this prisoner, to bring forth an accusation. Well, it says they sought for a witness against Jesus to put him to death. Did they find any?
No, false ones. They found plenty of false ones.
Well, wait a minute. What's in the first instance, they found none, right? And then this was bad. You know, there's nothing worse than to get into a box like this and have the whole thing all teed up and your whole rug pulled out. They didn't have any witnesses at this point of time to put the finger on him. Now, it says, they got some false witnesses, all right, later apparently, maybe just a few minutes later. And many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. How does this go in court? It's a very bad situation if you're in court and you say this man was traveling down the highway on Tuesday in the easterly direction, and he says it was Wednesday in a westerly direction. It's a very bad thing for a judge to figure out what really did happen. Well, there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. Well, is this so bad? How bad is this? What's the charge? Well, we heard this fellow say that he would destroy the temple in 3 days and build it in 3 more days. How bad is this? Yeah, it's not that bad, is it? Hardly worth putting a man to death over, certainly. But even then, they couldn't agree, as the other writers say, but neither did their witness agree together. So the high priest now has reached a virtual point of desperation. He's got no charge against him. The witnesses don't agree together. All the Sanhedrin, or nearly all of them, are sitting there, and the case is bogging down. So finally, in verse 60 it says, the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? He's asking Jesus what they're witnessing against him. Now, can you imagine anything worse in a court of fair trial than this, to ask the prisoner what it is he's there for? The thing is almost a joke. But he held his peace and answered nothing. What could he say? He had nothing to say. They're asking him what he's there for. Again, the high priest asked him and said unto him, ah, now here's something different. Art thou the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed? Remember, they wouldn't use the name God. Very particular here, you see. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. So they say, the Son of the Blessed. All right. They're very fussy on that point. But whether a man's life is cut off for no reason is of no moment, as Herman was talking about this morning. Now, he's asking them, is he the Messiah, eh? The Son of God. What's he saying? I am. Now, that is, in the eyes of the Sanhedrin, what kind of charge, or what is the, if you go around saying that, blasphemy. Ah, that, now we got something. Now we have something to hang our hat on. Here's a man that's blasphemous, because he says that he is the Messiah, the Son of God. So the high priest figures he's got a real point. Jesus admitted it. He didn't stand there and say nothing. He says, I am, or thou sayest it, which was a Hebrew idiom. Then the high priest said in verse 63, he rent his clothes and said, what need we of further witnesses? Never mind the witnesses now. He says, ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. So before this great august body that had just a few minutes before bogged down in legal procedure, now at the mouth of the at the lips of this witness, he stood self-confused. But this was not legal. In order to have the thing legal, you had to have another person accuse him of blasphemy. But here the high priest took the law in his own hands, and he, in effect, who was supposed to be the judge, turned out to be the accuser of this prisoner. Ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye? So they said, he is guilty of death. Now turn over to the 26th chapter of Matthew. And this is sort of a parallel account at verses 63 and 4. You can read that. He's under oath, even. He's under adjuration, which is under oath. In verse 63, I adjure thee by the living God, tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Now, in verse 65, then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, He hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? We don't need any witnesses. The man is self-condemned. Now, he says, what think ye? They answered, he is guilty of death. Now, this isn't germane to the argument, but I want to bring it in right now. How many of you have been reading these articles which have been appearing in the Advocate concerning a reprint of Blunt's book? Far too few. Let me tell you something. This man Blunt, who has written a book called Internal Scriptural Evidence, is one of the finest books of its kind that's ever been written. And next to this little book, which I have now, Who Moved the Stone, and which you can examine here after if you want to, has had a very profound effect upon me, at least. Blunt's Internal Scriptural Evidence. Get out your old Advocates and read it, because it's a wonderful book. It's out of print. Maybe Brother Mr. Ferguson could search it for you. However, here is one of the points that Blunt brings out, and I want to just run through it fast. And that is this. They say he's guilty of death. Verse 67. Then they did spit in his face and buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy unto us, thou Christ, or thou Messiah, who is he that smote thee? Now, what kind of business is this? Now, if any of you know this answer, just let the others think about it for a minute. What kind of language is this? Prophesy, thou Christ, who is he that smote thee? Now, look, here's the prisoner standing there, bound. He's got probably what we would call handcuffs or thongs on his back. So he's standing there, and somebody steps up and gives him a wallop over the cheek, and says, all right, thou Messiah, who is it that smote thee? What kind of language is this? You know, if Herman's up here and I give him a wallop on the chin, and then I say, all right now, Herman, if you're so smart, tell me who hit you. He doesn't have to be too smart to say it was Ted Farrer. Now, what's he saying? Prophesy unto us. Who is it that smote thee? Now, Blunt, this is a very simple incident of Blunt's whole theory. Now, do any of you know what the answer is? Yeah, that's right. Now, turn over to Luke, the parallel place in Luke 22 and 64, and you will see the reason why they said this, and it makes a lot of sense now. Luke 22 and 64. Brother Gelino, will you read that?
When they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, prophesy, who is it that smote thee?
Ah, now there's a different story. Now he's up here with blindfolds on. You know, he's also bound and he's got one of these on. Now somebody gives him a wallop. Now why did they say, prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is it that smote thee?
The
Messiah was supposed to have X-ray vision. You know, he was able to have the power of God, right? If he was the Son of God, if you're really the Messiah, we'll find out. We'll have a little test here while we're on trial. We'll put some blindfolds on you and we'll give you a good one. Now tell us, if you're so smart, who is it that smote thee? You see the point here? This was a messianic test. Now, this book of Blunt, the articles of which have been appearing in the Advocate for how many months? Jim? Quite a few years, I guess, is full of incidents of this kind in the Bible, which are wonderful. Absolutely, you just thrill you through and through from head to foot. Dig them out and read them, and you'll be thrilled, I think, as those who have read them are. Now, in the 27th chapter of Matthew, verse 1, when morning was come, daylight has now arrived, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. Now, apparently up to this time, While most of the Sanhedrin were there, remember the high priest and elders and scribes and so on, it says, but apparently right at daybreak they had one final shot at this thing when they called them all in. Maybe some of them couldn't get up as early as others, but it says here all. How all is all, I don't know, but it says all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. So the whole council were in this thing. So what did they decide to do in verse 2? And what was their verdict from the whole council at this point? Yeah, they condemned him to death. And then they decided to take him before Pilate. Now, why did they do that?
They had no authority.
They had no authority over that.
Right. Now, look at John 18 and 31 on that point, because this is important. This is how Pilate gets in the act. The 18th chapter of John and verse 31. Sister Stone? Huh? 18 and 31 of John. So there's the reason, right, why they had to take him to Pilate, because it was not lawful. They could take a man up to imprisonment, scourging, and so on, but it was not lawful for them to put any man to death. So now they bring him before Pilate. And in, this is in, let's see now, this is in John 18. We'll stay there. In verse 28, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas into the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Again, they were very meticulous about the niceties of the law, but a man's life was expendable. All right, now here, now they come. Pilate then went out unto them and said, what accusation bring ye against this man? Now you brought me a man, and remember we said that somebody had to step up and accuse a man charged with something. So Pilate, look, he was a Roman governor, he wasn't a fool, and he wasn't particularly partisan one way or the other. So they bring him up, all in a hubbub, and they stand there, and so is this a logical question? Okay, he's there, what's the charge? Is this fair enough?
Yes.
Yeah, very fair. What's the charge? So what did they say?
If he weren't a malefactor, he wouldn't be brought
here. Yeah, what's a malefactor?
Bad fellow.
Yeah.
Bad.
Mal, the mare, is sick from the sea. Seasickness. Mal. Bad. So a malefactor is the opposite to a benefactor. It's a man who makes for badness. So they, did they say, well, the charge is A, B, and C? They said, well, I'll tell you, Pilate, if he weren't such a bad fellow, we would not have delivered him unto thee. Is this a, is this a charge that you would expect to be brought into court?
No.
No, that's, no wonder, Pilate, what kind of business is this? If he weren't a malefactor, we wouldn't have brought him here. Then said Pilate unto them, well, fine, if he's a malefactor, take ye him and judge him according to your law. I don't want any to do it if that's all you've got, that he's a malefactor, which is a sort of a nebulous charge. Take him and judge him according to your law. I don't want anything to do with it. And the Jews said, well, we can't put him to death. We've got to have you in on this thing, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and asked Jesus and said unto him. Now Pilate, you see, shouldn't have done this. He should have said, well, look, if there's no charge, get out of here, because I don't want to hear anything. But he didn't. He sort of got in the act too. And he said, because he was probably interested in Jesus, that he was a very notorious figure in Palestine at this time. So Pilate thought he'd have a little session too. So he says, art thou the king of the Jews? But before we get to that, I want to go back to the 23rd of Luke, and I should have done this. I'm sorry, because when they said if he weren't a malefactor, we wouldn't have brought him here. Luke fills that in a bit, and this is important. Luke 23 and 2. Yeah, this is very important, because this is a connecting link between that and the other. Marie, you got that? All right. Now, did they come along with this charge? No. They came along with three things wrong. And what was the first?
Perverting the nation.
Two? Forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar. And three? Making himself a king. Now, what if this is all under the general title of either treason or sedition. Sedition is not quite as bad as treason, but nearly. Now you see the difference in the charge. When they came here before the Jewish court, they accused him of blasphemy. When they got to the Roman court, Pilate couldn't care less about blasphemy, but he did care about anything that was going to upset the empire. So when they got there, they said, now look, here's the charge. This man, number one, he's perverting this nation. Very serious charge. Number two, he refuses to pay taxes to Caesar. Now look, when you're dealing with money, it's all right for a joke, but you know, when you want to withhold money from Caesar, this is exceedingly serious. And number three, he says he's a king. Now who is the king of the Roman Empire?
Caesar.
So he's challenging Caesar's authority, according to them. All three are very serious charges. So Pilate says, art thou the king of the Jews? Let's get that one through first. He says, art thou the king of the Jews? Now this, I think we'll go back to the 18th of John for this one. This is in the 33rd verse of the 18th of John, the same question. Art thou the king of the Jews? Now this is a funny answer Jesus gave. He said, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? Now what this means this, I think. Jesus is saying, really, he isn't trying to be impudent here and saying, hey, now look, did you conjure up this idea yourself, or did somebody feed it into your brain? He's trying to answer the thing. Pilate says, are you the king of the Jews? Now here's a man on trial for his life. So I think Jesus is saying something like this. He's saying, in what sense are you using the word king? If you're asking me if I claim to be an earthly king like Caesar, the answer is no. Because, he says, my kingdom is not of this world. If that's the kind of a king you're talking about, no, I'm not that kind of a king. So I deny the charge. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight? Now, when lawyers have a case like this, any little thing that comes along that they can hang their hat on, they hang right in court, as you know, and often the wit of the lawyers is much more important than the case itself. In fact, these days, nearly always. So here's a prisoner who gets up and says, my kingdom isn't in this world. No, I'm not that kind of a king at all. You know, as a matter of fact, if my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight? Now let me ask you this, and Brother Russell, keep quiet for a minute because you've already got this in your notes. was there ever any occasion when his servants did fight and use a sword? When was it? Yeah, the very night before, maybe, 6 hours before, his servants did fight, and one of them drew a sword and went to cleave the skull of a servant of the high priest, and he probably went like this, and he scaled down and got his ear off. So, wouldn't it be wonderful to say, well, what do you mean your kingdom isn't of this world, otherwise your servants would fight? Well, this last night, your servants did fight. What was wrong with bringing Malchus on the stand and saying, yeah, one of the servants fought me, they nearly tried to kill me? No, or something worse than that.
His ear was back on.
Yeah, his ear was back on. And it was the whole evidence of Malchus on this point would recoil against him. So he didn't dare bring Malchus up there and confute this charge about this business of the servants not fighting. He'd be the worst witness they could ever find. So Malchus they kept back in the courtyard. All right, so he says, now if you're talking about the sense in which I'm trying to compete with Caesar, no, my kingdom isn't that kind. But if you're using the words the way the Jews are talking about, what sort of a king I claim to be, then that's a different story. So Pilate tries to clear this thing up. He says in verse, let's see now. Oh, in verse 35, he says, am I a Jew? I'm interested in what kind of a king you're talking about in this Jewish lingo at all. I want to know the facts. So Jesus then gives what they call a defense of confession and avoidance. He confesses, yes, I am a king, that's true, but not in the sense that you're talking about, namely that I'm competing with Caesar. So Pilate then asked this famous question, and this is in verse 38. Pilate, after this controversy went on for a while, he said, what is truth? Now, I don't think that at this point Pilate was saying, we will now have a philosophical discussion about what truth is. We'll stop the trial and we'll all get down and call in the philosophers and the wise men and figure out what truth is. I think he was saying to himself, what is the truth of this thing anyway? Well, how are we going to handle this? This is sort of the sense, I think, he said, what is truth? Well, what is the facts of this case? Well, we must go on rather quickly. He was then taken to Herod, and every time that either Pilate or Herod dealt with the matter, as you will read on here in John, you will find that Pilate kept on saying, I don't find anything wrong with this man. And nor yet Herod, he couldn't find anything wrong with him. So finally, Pilate said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll scourge him and let him go. Now, what they used for a scourge was a little, neat little thing called a flagellum, which was a rod out of which nice, strong, nicely shellacked leather thongs went with pieces of steel or bronze all down them. So when you bent over the thing and you got hit with a flagellum with these nice steel barbs going in, it was no mean thing. But it seemed for Pilate, well, we'll scourge him and let him go. You know, we'll not hurt him very much. We'll just give him the flagellum, that's all, and we'll let him go. And he got it. He was scourged with this terrible Roman instrument. Well, this still didn't satisfy the Jews. And in the 19th chapter of John, at verse 7, we have the trial now getting down to the point where the thing had to be settled. And so the Jews answered him and said, we have a law, and by our law he ought to die. This is what we were talking about yesterday, about a prophet like unto Moses, and if he wasn't the real one, he should die, who, because he made himself the Son of God. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was more afraid. Why was he afraid? Because he heard that saying. Ah, they said, no, don't forget, Pilate was a superstitious Roman. They had gods and spirits and all these things. So when they said, and he was a little bit afraid of Jesus too, no doubt, and they said, the trouble with him is that he said he was the Son of God. Pilate got nervous. Now, wait a minute, am I dealing with something supernatural here? So it says, when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid, and went again into the judgment hall, and said unto Jesus, Whence art thou? He wanted to get one more reason to let him go. But Jesus gave him no answer. So then, in verse 12, From henceforth therefore Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, Now listen to this. This is a little different wrinkle now. If thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend. Whoso maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. Now who's on trial? Pilate's on trial, brethren, right here at this point. Because they said, look, this man says he's a king. Now, if you don't accuse him of treason and sedition for saying he's a king, you're betraying the man who pays your salary, namely Caesar. So Pilate, you think he was afraid when they said he was the Son of God? They said, if thou let this man go, you're a traitor to Caesar. Now this was something, this is a little different. It's all right having some Jew on trial, but don't put me on trial, said Pilate. And this is exactly what the whole company of the Sanhedrin were doing. They were putting Pontius Pilate on trial for treason himself. And so, when Pilate heard that saying, what happened? What happened? Tell me what happened. When he heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat him down in the judgment seat. And what happened then? Yeah, they said that. Washed his hands. And then what happened? They led him out to be crucified.
I think we all appreciate very much, as we do all the teachers. I think we ought to pressure in a very small way to do by all the time.